What's up, Stitches? Welcome to episode 2 of 2023. This is the So What podcast, and I am your host, Isabella Rosner. Thanks for being here today. This episode is an interview because I am in my interview era, clearly. And it's a chat with embroidery artist Danielle Clough all about her stitch-centric art. You may know Danielle as Fiance Knowles, which is her Instagram handle, and it's maybe my favorite Instagram username of all time. It's definitely up there. I have loved Danielle's embroidery for a really long time, so it's super exciting to get a chance to talk with her. I first saw Danielle's needlework on tennis rackets when I was scrolling through Tumblr back in 2016. I thought that Danielle's embroidered tennis rackets were the coolest, most creative, and most joyful things ever. So I am living my 21-year-old self's dream right now. What fun! Before we get into who Danielle is and then into the interview itself, it's time for the social media spiel. You know it. You love it. You have been waiting for it, I am sure. I know you haven't. To see images of and links to what we discuss in today's episode, go to So What Podcast, SEWWHAT Podcast, on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. Or check out SoWhatPodcast.com. I know you love content, and I love to provide the content. Okay, after that little aside, it's finally time to find out more about today's esteemed guest, Danielle Clough. Born and bred in Cape Town, South Africa, Danielle Clough uses an array of threads and wool to create bold and quirky images on surfaces from coffee bags to rusted iron gates. Since graduating from the Red and Yellow School of Advertising in 2010, Clough has jumped between various jobs and disciplines, while embroidery has remained a constant hobby. Her vocation as an embroiderer has grown slowly since 2013. She has been profiled by Instagram, Colossal, CNN, Vogue.com, Beautiful Bizarre, High Fructose, and The Creators Project, and has been published in the New York Times, Casse de Jardim, Evening Standard, Inspirations, and Homespun, amongst others. Her work has caught the attention of prominent clients such as Gucci, Adobe, the African Innovation Foundation, the United Nations, Origins, Nike, Adidas, and Drew Barrymore. She has also stepped into the realm of education with online classes and real-world workshops to help aspiring embroiderers learn and appreciate the craft of embroidery. She's taught workshops in South Africa, Australia, Canada, and soon the US. Danielle has exhibited her embroidery locally and internationally. Her first solo show, Highly Strung, was exhibited in 2019, and she has exhibited in group shows all over the world. She's working towards an embroidery show in Philadelphia in September of this year. Thrilling! Now, before we get into the interview, a quick note to say that there are some slight audio issues in the recording of my conversation with Danielle. Every so often, Danielle's sound cuts out, but I don't think there are too many issues. I think you'll understand basically all of it. The sound cuts out towards the beginning when Danielle says that her school was above a fabric shop. I'm mentioning that instance in particular because that's an important detail. And later in the episode, Danielle shows me a piece she's just finished stitching and the photograph she was stitching from. It's hard to envision that, of course, because podcasting is not a visual platform, and Danielle can't share that photo and embroidery just yet, but the good news is I am sharing a bunch of photos and videos across the So What social media pages that give you a really good idea of Danielle's process. Okay, let's get into it. Danielle, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Like I said to you, it just feels like I know you because I've been listening to your podcast for a while. So I'm like, this feels very casual to me because I'm like, oh, I finally get to do, you know, now you basically can hear me talking back because I've been giggling and like, oh yeah, wow, that's amazing.
So exciting. And now you get to actually see like how much I move my hands and like how really like excited and sweaty I get during this. So yeah, it's the immersive experience. How did you come to embroidery? What was your career journey? Take me on this adventure with you, if you would, please.
Okay, so it's really, The embroidery part of the journey is really embarrassing.
Excited.
But I know, I knew you would be. I knew you would be. So I had always been around textiles, like thread and fabric and a sewing machine. My mom would sew. So my mom's not very creative. She works a corporate job and she would make clothes. There was always just kind of around. So I'd never really thought about sewing as a creative medium. It was just something that was really kind of natural. So when I went to school, my mom taught me how to sew, and I kind of realized near the end of my, like in grade 11 or 12, so the last 2 years of regular school, that I had a creative inclination, and I was quite adamant that I was going to be this fashion designer. So my mom was teaching me to make these clothes, and I would make like these really hideous clothes out of old curtains and like jackets where you couldn't put your arms down and they still had the rings in it. And so I just had this like kind of naturally going on this journey of clothing, fabric, sewing. And I dropped out of mainstream school. I did a visual arts matric so that I could get into fashion school and be like the next South Africa's Coco Chanel. I was like
Yes.
fixated on fashion. And
Wow.
I did this alternative matric in visual art, and I loved it. It was really kind of like a bit of a dropout school, if you will. And we did things like potato printing and like really rudimentary things. But
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved working with my hands, and I loved kind of like being creative, which was something I didn't really know that I was until I was, much older. And yeah, and then I went and I studied fashion design, and I absolutely hated it. It was, I just don't, and I was like so adamant. I was like, really? I would wear these hideous clothes. I was thinking I was going to be great, and went into fashion design, was absolutely useless, really didn't enjoy it, and I dropped. So subsequently, I've become a big advocate for quitting, but that's, that
Oh,
comes later.
nice.
And then, yeah, I went and I did this. I went to did a whole lot of different things after dropping out because I kind of went on this journey of elimination, like a process of elimination, of trying all sorts of different things to figure out what it is that I don't want, what it is that I wanted to do. I was so adamant about this fashion design thing that it really, sometimes when you're wrong and nobody else tells you that you are wrong. I had to tell myself that I was wrong, that my dreams and my aspirations were wrong. It really shook me, I was like, well, who am I if I'm not this thing that I had envisioned that I was going to be, this epic
So
fashion, through this process of elimination, I worked as a like a in a design house. I worked for photographers. I did some styling, and I just realized that what I wanted to do was everything. I just wanted like, and that was what I actually wanted with the fashion design stuff, is I wanted to think about the clothing, fabrics. I just wanted to be fully involved in this creative process from concept to execution. And as a 19-year-old, I didn't really know how to go about that in terms of like studying and tertiary education. So I studied advertising and I did art direction and graphic design. And I love, yeah, so it's very commercial. So I think it's very much how I approach my work now is very much from a commercial space. But the school, okay, how we get into the embroidery. So the school actually was located above a lot of the projects that I had while studying advertising had like a fabric lilt to it. So like I made up an advert for Wool and the Gang because I was like obsessed with Wool and the Gang.
Love
And this
that.
is like 10 years ago, 10 or no, 15 years ago, something crazy. And I was just so into the brand that I made this like fake advert for it. And I would go and buy wool and I would try making things for these like fake adverts. And a lot of my work had that kind of, while I was studying. And it was above a fabric store. So I would go with my fellow students and we would like run down to the fabric store, pick out fabrics. They would draw these monsters and then I would make them because I had all this background in making clothes because of what my mom had taught me. And blah, 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 blah. I used to be making these plush toy, these like little plush toys all the time. And I would kind of like create these details on these plush toys. So I would draw like little smiles and anchors and everything. So because of these plush toys, I always had a needle and thread and fabric on me. I was always just kind of stuffed in the bottom of my bag and between projects or between classes while I was sitting with my friends who had drawn these little monsters up, I would like be stitching them together. And I also had a side job and I was working at this gallery and I had nothing. Okay, so this is the embarrassing story of how I discovered embroidery. I had nothing on me at the time except for this needle and thread in my bag and I think maybe like a pen. And the owner of the gallery came downstairs, handed me a laptop, and was like, find buyers, go Google something, 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 and you know, be, I don't know, a grower. You know, I'm like, I'm a student that just wants to sew these little toys. Anyway, so I'm sitting with this laptop and it's in front of me, and I'm like trying to open it, and I cannot for the life of me open it. So I'm like pressing, I'm like trying to slide these little things and like unclip them and everything. And I'm like, I know that this gallery owner is going to come downstairs and he's going to be like, what are you doing? Why are you staring at this closed laptop? So I was like, I have to just look busy. Like, whatever happens, I have to look busy. So I look in my bag and all I have is one pen, a scrap piece of felt, some red thread, and a needle. So I just start like making marks on this little piece of felt. And I kind of like doodled this little bunny. Awesome. I've invented a whole new art form, obviously.
Okay, well, it's like, what's the embarrassing part? And now you have revealed the
Well,
embarrassing part.
the fact I couldn't open the laptop because I had it the wrong way around, and
One.
subsequently thought I had embroidered, I had an inv subsequently thought I had invented embroidery,
Quite.
and I was like, thread sketching. I put it on my blog, which was called Mother Cluffer, and I put it online, and I was like, I have invented a whole new medium. Yeah, and I just kept kind of doodling, and you know, didn't take me long, and much to the dismay of my ego, realized that this has been around for centuries. I am definitely not the first, and just kept doodling, and these little drawings just evolved, and that is how I found embroidery. You know, while I was working as a graphic designer, after I finished studying, I worked as a waitress, as a VJ, as a photographer, as all these different things. Sewing was this thing that was mine. That I did on the side, that I would do on Sundays or while watching TV or in bed or take it to the coffee shop. And that passion, I guess, just evolved and grew. And I think it was in 2016, I also had the same thing as I wanted to be the world's best fashion designer. I was like, I am going to be the Don of embroidery in Cape Town.
Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be really because I wanted to make jewelry. And I'm sure you've seen Dandelion made these mini embroidery hoops. I was like, I'm going to get these. And I used to go to op shops and, you know, go buy all these like secondhand embroideries. I was like, this is how I'm going to make embroidery popular in South Africa because I think it's amazing. And I never thought I was ever going to like make money from my own work. I just thought I was going to be able to make money from the medium or hopefully make something from the medium. So I applied for a thing called Design Indaba in 2016, and for that I had to build a website for the application. So I put some of my own work in in this website for that. So yeah, and I got into Design Indaba, but before it actually ended up picking up because of the website, that my work got spread because I put it online and people started spreading it, and then the rackets got picked up by This Is Colossal, and then within 3 months I was a full-time embroiderer.
Oh my God. Wait, when
Yeah.
was it? 2016?
2016.
Oh my gosh. I remember, I just from I don't know what corner of the internet I was on in 2016, but I remember seeing the rackets and being like, whoa. Like I remember where I was. I remember having conversations with people about it. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
Congratulations.
thanks. I mean, it's still quite surreal, you know. I was just doing this thing on Sunday evenings and then I just loved it and kept doing it. And I think I've been confident enough to feel like, well, if people don't like it, they'll just keep scrolling. But like, here's a thing I made. Here's a thing I made. And was very like open about it. And oh, it just escalated pretty rapidly. I had to
That
hang up
is,
my apron.
oh my gosh. There's something like that is so interesting. First of all, great story. Thank you for
Thank
being
you.
open about the two embarrassing parts of that story. I appreciate your vulnerability. I also find it like so crazy. 2016 was not that long ago, but it feels like it just feels like the tennis racket thing is really timeless. And I felt like, I can't believe it's only been around for 7 years. I feel like I've heard about your work with that specific work specifically for much longer. The fact that you found this when you were trying to look productive is absolutely wild when one thinks about like needlework and productivity. That's such a rich area of research. I have so many questions about how you embroider. First of all, I love it. You know this. Love your work. I have for a really long time. But I think you have such a unique house style. Your house is you. You are your own house. Your work is so, you can always tell it's by you, by Danielle Clough. And I guess my big question is like color. How do you pick your use of color? That's one of the things where like, in addition to how you actually make your stitches, like kind of how you make your brush strokes, the color always feels so significant and like it's really part of your larger oeuvre. I can't even pronounce that word. You know, your larger kind of your work, your body.
The narrative, I guess kind of the it's a big tool in the work that I create, or elements in the work that I create. So I mean, if I look back at it, I think I've always been very attracted to color. When I was a teenager, I painted my room, like two walls were like fuchsia and the other two were magenta, and they were basically the same version of very bright purpley pink. And then I had this huge neon celestial. You know, my mom would come home and I'm like painting the celestial sun in the corner in neon colors, and just like, oh, you know. And if I look back at the clothes that I was making myself, they're all very colorful. So I think color's just been something that I've naturally always loved, like bright, saturated colors. But I think also, you know, if I look at like my work and then teaching, because when I teach color, I've had to really break it down, because you don't necessarily want to teach somebody how to replicate your relationship with color, because it's shifting and everybody's relationship with color is shifting and everybody has their own color language. So if you open your cupboards right now and you look at your clothing, you're going to see things that are similar in there. And when you go into a shop and you see a fabric and it's a floral fabric next to another floral fabric, but they're different colorways, one is going to resonate with you. And that's your color language. You know, that's your natural style and your natural inclination. So it's just actually, essentially, when that comes down to work, is it's about pulling those colors and applying them to the right place so that you can shape the story or the image that you want. So there's this very well-known phrase which says, color gets the credit, value does the work. So when I work, yeah, I love it. I tell
A
everyone that.
good one. I
I've
love
even
it.
got a little. I've got a little workshop notebook here where I've like drawn a little thing and I've written it, and it's like it's so true. You know, when you take any. So this is how I approach color. You know, on a practical level, is when you take a image of anything that we see in values. So when something has a light area and it has a dark area and there's all the shades in between, we can still see what that is. So essentially what I do with color is I just apply colors to values. So a dark shadow will be a dark blue or a dark red or a dark purple, and a light green, a light yellow, a light orange, whatever. As long as the values are right, then the story is still going to be there. And the colors just get to be this like complete indulgence of just joy. So if I'm really feeling like I just want to work with pinks and purples, I'll do that. And then I'll be working within those values to tell the story, but enjoying just the colors. And then if I get bored of the pinks and the purples, I'm like, I'm going to get some blue in here, which is usually how I have these crazy palettes, because I just get really bored really quickly.
It. Yes, it adds so much joy to the work. I think one of the reasons why I love your work so much is because it's really visually comprehensible. That's a weird thing to say, but like because of the way that you work with color, you can see every stitch. And like when you from far away, you're like, that is an image of a thing, and I can identify that as a face or as fruit or something. But when you get close, each stitch does actually tell its own story and has a unique relationship to the other stitches around it because of the color variation.
Yes, and also the texture, which is so one of the other things that I love so much about color and thread is that And I guess I'm sure painters feel the same about their medium, but I love like a juicy wool, and I love like a shiny rayon and how they interact with each other and in different lights, how that looks, whether you're in a flat light and everything looks flat, it just looks like a painting, or if the light comes from the side and some of the threads have a shine and not, it just feels very dynamic. I have a very saturated color palette, and I have friends who are really into beiges and autumn tones and like real olive greens, and I'm just like, I can't do it. I can't hack it. I don't see what you see. I there's there and it's just like that. So I think one of the things about color, and what I also when I do these, like when I teach it, is like take something that you love, like a piece of fabric, and then break it down into values, and then you apply those values, and that way you'll be looks like the image that you're trying to create, but with colors that you love, that like are going to feed you.
Yes. Oh, I love it. I like thinking about the way that you handle color and texture, like through stitch, in comparison to things like needle painting from from like the 18th century, or like Chinese silk embroidery, where like the emphasis on both is about like a very naturalistic way of handling shading through stitch and through
Yes.
color variation. I like. I don't know. I think your work is so interesting because it kind of takes
Thank
the
you.
same principle. No problem. It's just me. It's just a journey of me hyping you up. I hope that's okay.
I don't know what to
It's
do
so,
with it,
I truly
but
love
thank
it so much. And I think I really love it when I think about it in conversation with historical pieces because you're
you.
using the same building blocks and the same kind of interest in color and variation of color to create something completely different. You're basically taking, I don't know, I've comprehended it as taking similar, you're taking like a real life thing. And so, whether you're in the 18th century or today, you're taking a real life thing and then you're replicating it in your own way through stitch. In the 18th century, people were really interested in the smoothest transition from dark to light possible. And you also have that dark to light thing, but you break it down. Things are kind of going in different directions and are a bit like there's less of a like an ombre and more of like a kind of fractured thing. And I think it so speaks to like, I don't know, how we think about brightness and color and tone generally today.
So spot on. It's also, I think it's also, that's striving for perfection, so that naturalism, that perfect shading is trying to create, like making it feel and look as natural as possible, and also as le almost less like thread. So you're not celebrating the fact that it is thread because you're trying to create something else with the medium, which is amazing because that's such a challenge in itself.
It's all about the artist's hand, and I think your hand is very clear.
It's quite interesting teaching because you also open up. You open up to so much. Well, you're handing over all that information and all of that technique and all of the stuff that you're building based on intuition. So you build a style based on intuition and a technique based on X, and then you kind of just give it over. So I also don't necessarily feel like my work is that unique anymore. Not because I'm like being copied or anything, but because I have handed over these techniques, I've got. People are like replicating things I make, and I'm like, oh, it's so easy for people to do what I do, So it's very humbling in that way. So it's quite nice to hear that I have a style and that it is recognizable.
The replication of your work has kind of unintentionally turned, I don't know, it's like a workshop. It's not like that, but kind of like a group of people who have come together to create something kind of cohesive.
Which
Interesting.
is actually, I mean, it's one of the reasons I started teaching and I did the workshops was exactly for that, is that it's so easy to be possessive, and the nature of the embroidery community isn't about that. It is about like the passing on of techniques and the passing on of stories. And if you sit and you're like, I've got this thing and it's mine, you're almost doing such a disservice to like the big scale of what this medium and community and that actually ends up feeding you, giving you so much that if you don't give it back, it's you really are like breaking the system.
That's a nice mindset, and one that I think is like really actually tied into how embroidery has always been taught. Like in the period that I look at, which is early modern, there are no needlework instruction manuals from the 17th century. And it's kind of one of those things where everybody's like, okay, so how are people learning? They were clearly learning by teaching each other in person. They were not learning from books. They were learning from each other. And I think that is what has so much of what has kept embroidery alive is the learning from people themselves, the learning from the practitioners, and the passing on of that embodied knowledge. What is your process? How do you go about making a piece of embroidery?
It always starts with a reference. So a reference, but the inspiration will come from something, either a material or watching a movie and really falling for something, a little bit of nostalgia, some kind of emotional response. Then I'll be like, I really need to do Show from Clueless because, what a time to be alive. And then I get the reference picture. So I like taking my own reference photos. I kind of have a background in photography, so I'll take a photograph, edit it. If I'm working directly from a photographic reference, then I will put it into black and white, trace it onto the fabric or to whatever surface I'm working on, and then essentially color it in with thread. And another kind of like few segues that I've been taking in that process is to remove it as much from being something perfect as possible. So I've been working with Procreate. So Procreate is like a digital drawing program, and then taking a photograph or taking something, really working with it in Procreate, and then using that. Sometimes I'll edit the hue and saturation or just the hue so that whatever colors I chose end up being completely different, and then
Nice.
using that as my reference. Yeah, and then painting, and I've been doing some painting classes. So essentially just like finding something that I'm excited about, whether it's a material or a tool, taking something photographic, like taking a reference image, and then kind of trying to imperfect it somewhere and then stitching it.
Love that. And do you, okay, this might be a basic question. I don't even know. Like, will you then have the reference image that you've zhuzhed in Procreate up on a screen and you are replicating
Yeah, so I can show you. This
it?
is a perfect example. Hey, I'm running away. Okay, so this is kind of how I'll work. So this is a piece that I've just finished today,
Congratulations.
Daniel.
Okay.
So
Ooh.
this is the photograph. So the photograph is actually like I photoshopped her body wasn't in the right pose, so I photoshopped her face to a different version of her body with a whole lot of different references. And then I'll edit it a little bit so that it's got nice contrast. Having strong dark areas and strong light areas gives you so much more room to play with color. Then here's like my Photoshop
Amazing.
version
Yeah.
for after my Photoshop. And I've actually been using a watercolor. I use the watercolor brush here and then wanting to play with watercolor on fabric. And then here's my final, which has the watercolor on the fabric. So you can see there.
That is
And then
amazing.
here's some
The texture, look at
the.
that. Wow.
Oh. So it's hard when you can't actually see, but I mean, people can't see because the podcast. But yeah, so that's kind of the thing of having something photographic, then altering it, and then having it in, and then stitching it, and then trying to keep it because this is this piece for you all. Because some pieces I do are for commercial jobs, then the drawing process is a way for the client to sign off and know what I'm going to stitch. Because once you're stitching, you can't be like, actually, can we just move that slightly to the left? You're like, there's no control alt delete with the needle and thread. So it does help in that way. But also just I really like removing myself from a perfect photograph. It takes away the pressure of having to create something that looks right. And because when you're creating something that looks has to look right, like look perfect, then you're only going to see things that are wrong with it.
I think that your process is like so glorious because it really speaks to how contemporary technology and ways of making art can inform the creation of this art that's been around for so long. Like you're really doing
Totally.
nice.
I mean, again, when I teach, I think it's so exciting. Like your phone is a magnificent tool. Okay, I often find myself just like going for walks, and if I see like sour figs, which are these like beautiful It's like an indigenous flower, and it's got these beautiful fuchsia, like soft leaves, and there are always bees all over it. So just like snap a couple photos. There's always inspiration. And often, like if I do workshops and people don't have any, like, oh, I don't have a reference photo, it just goes through. Maybe you've got a picture of your dog that you like, or maybe you took a picture of a flower or a gecko, and you have it. Like everybody has something that they love on their phone. And you've then created your own reference, completely unique embroidery.
Okay, I have to ask. I have one. I think it's my final question about you and your stitching, if that is okay.
Okay, of course.
What if you can pick one? What is your favorite thing about embroidery, and what is your least favorite thing?
Okay, one. Oof, oof, oof.
You can pick multiple. You can pick multiple if you want.
Can I give you two answers? Can I give
Yeah.
you two answers? My favorite thing about the act of embroidery is the colors and the textures. Like, I get so jazzed over like a really good pink wool, or if I see like I'll just throw things into a basket. I don't care what it costs. That to me, is just an innate natural thrill that the
That.
act or the process of embroidery gives me. So one of my favorites. And then holistically, embroidery is probably the community and what it represents, the community currently, like the historical community, and the kind of legacy that you become a part of, or that you're in. Like, I did a workshop in Canada with the Canadian Embroiderers Guild of London, Ontario.
Ah,
One of the most
lovely.
magic, they are incredible. It was a 4-day workshop, and I left so full. It was like everybody connected, and it was this medium that just has a way of getting people to communicate, has a way of getting everyone to kind of like disarm, because you've got some common, but then it's also something that we've been doing since the beginning of time. So to be a part of that is just like incredible. I mean, for me, I feel like being a blip on this massive, 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 massive legacy and lineage of needle thread is just so, yeah, it's just so wonderful. It's really, really, to me, it's just make that's one of my favorite parts, as you can probably tell by my
Love it.
enthusiastic rant.
And I
Me,
relate. So, yes.
I know.
Yes.
It's amazing. We've had this, humans, people have had this innate need to embellish cloth and to show our identity, or to gift, or to communicate through these embellishments, meaning of time, or of his our recordings of his, like of time. And it's just like really cool. That's my favorite.
Okay, love that. Also great combo. Like I think obviously your second point about being part of this lineage and this community is like very tied to the past, of course. And I obviously love to see it. But your first point is also so interestingly tied to the past, I think, because the excitement about thread colors is like, I don't know, I think about thread colors all the time and like dyes over the course of history and what dyes have been used, what is color fast, what is like, you know, what has changed over time and when technology has changed what's available. And I oftentimes think about what it would have been like in what, like the 1850s when all of a sudden you're getting all of these new thread colors because of chemical dyes and the world has new color in it. All of a sudden, you're accessing all of these tones you've never seen before. And what joy and excitement, and kind of like what kind of overwhelming experiences you must have been having in the thread shop, in the haberdashery, in wherever, when you have this kind of this world, this rainbow that you had never seen before.
The class shift that happened when things started becoming mechanized, and because obviously, because of the cost of natural dyes, just of alum, to be able to make dye sets of all of that, and was just so inaccessible for most people. And it was also like that for a reason. If you were wearing something that was, crimson, you had status. And then all of a sudden, to be able to have access to these colors, kind of must have been so, if you were, it was happening, must have been so liberating to be like almost able to have access and to be able to enjoy and indulge in these created like created division between you and the haves and the have nots, or the haves more, you know. I think it must have been really amazing to see that shift in classism and through access.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, oh, the theme of this episode, which I love, was not expecting, but I'm so into it, is like the joy and curiosity of color, isn't it? Like what it's been
Definitely.
like in the past, what it's like today. Because I think you can't tell because I'm wearing just like a boring purple jumper, but like I love color as well. I love pattern, I love color, I love the brightness of it all. And it's I think one of the things that appeals to me so much in your work, and in it's one of the many things that appeals to me about needlework of the past, thinking about how so much of this needlework that, like, when you look at stitching from centuries ago, you're like, oh, it's very, you know, it's very matte, it's very sophisticated, it's very light pastel tones. Not oftentimes, some like a lot of the time, this stuff was really bright. And
Yeah.
it just
And it's also just aged, you know, oxidized. You know,
right.
these amazing, I think about all these
It, yeah.
amazing gold work that we have was meant to be, because I think it's Van Gogh's white flowers or something like that were actually, they've discovered were originally red, but because he used to just use cheap color mint, they all the colors gone out of it. So our idea of these historical paintings is also potentially warped.
Totally. Yeah, I think we forget that people have always, you said it very well earlier. You were like, people have for centuries, for millennia, everybody has always wanted to embellish fabric. But I think alongside that, people have always wanted to be around bright, beautiful colors. I
Oh,
think,
yeah.
yeah. Oh, there, people of the past are not different to us. They also loved a bit of a garish color.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I naturally love deeply saturated colors, and all my friends who are very like chic, you know, and only wear muted colors. And I don't also want to trash on them, because
Yeah.
color is, like I say, color is like a natural thing. It is also your taste, you know, and I think sometimes like bright colors get this, you know, they get a lot of glory, because I think maybe it's like a social thing where people feel like if you like use bright colors, you're seen as being like courageous and brave, where, which is, you know, which is maybe something that we will change in time, and it always changes with like fashion and stuff. But yeah, it's interesting to see, because I sometimes feel like I almost get a little bit like wild with my colors, but then I see other people who use colors maybe more subtly, maybe more muted colors or desaturated colors, and maybe don't get as much credit because they're not seen as being like brave or courageous, whereas actually they're just equally, if not more, skilled in the art of
Yeah.
color.
Yeah. It's all very, it's personal. We each have our own colors that bring us joy.
Completely.
Love it. Okay. Do you have anything you dislike about embroidery?
How slow it is sometimes I love that about it, but I think I often I can be a little bit resentful who can like churn things out, and for me to go from like idea to completion takes so long, and then a lot of that stuff gets binned, and then that's like a long process of failure. So I think that's probably the hardest. To work abstract or to loosen up your process is really difficult, because it's so time consuming to build the skill and to build the foundation of whatever you're working on.
Totally. Respect to everybody who stitches all over the world at any time period. The work is slow, but the work is great. You're doing great. What is your favorite needleworked object or objects? You can pick more than one if you want, or just one.
So I would say, again, two-part answer, currently and probably always and forever, any work of Bisa Butler's, just I
Yeah.
melt. I see it and I go, oh, that is so incredible. I'm so lazy. I'm just, oh, I wish I could just roll myself up in that quilt. I have every feeling when I see any work of Bisa's. And
Real.
she's just amazing. She is just on every level incredible. On a personal level, so that's kind of like, if on the whole world, if the world was just me in this little apartment, my favorite piece of needlework is a blanket my mom made me for my 30th birthday. And she crocheted it so that she would, she said she wanted to stop drinking so much red wine at night. So she was like, I'm just going to keep my hands busy so that I drink my glass of wine slower.
Oh my
And
God.
she, that's, that was her.
That's got real mom energy, doesn't it? I love
Full
that.
mom energy. And then unraveling a little bit, so I took it to my gran to fix. So it's got, and I asked her if she would fix it with a different color so that I'll always know what her contribution of it is. So it's really, it's like a typical embroidery story or needlework story. I've kind of like over-engineered the magic, but I'll pass it on one day and it will, keep the story alive.
I love that. I mean, I was going to say you are one of the only people I've interviewed for this podcast that didn't come. Well, actually, that's wrong. I was going to say you didn't come to embroidery specifically because of like a mom or a grandma who taught you, but that's kind of not true because your mom did do a lot of sewing and it gave to you the love of sewing. But I guess in a more literal way of passing on the needlework things. I mean, the blanket's a good example of the power of the lineage of women. I love to see it. And the role
I
that
love.
wine plays in all of this.
I know. Well, I think wine plays a lot in the whole history of embroidery since the beginning.
100%.
The embroidery, I'm pretty sure, is like if you had to go into it. And like really, I don't know, do like a forensic test, you'd 100% find wine.
Wine
There's
everywhere. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You and your mom
absolutely
are just following in the long lineage of wine.
wine drinking stitches.
That's right. Wine drinking stitchers. Yes. Oh, great answers. Love to hear a Bisa Butler shout out on the pod. What an icon.
Absolute icon.
Also, very fun for me listening to one of my favorite textile artists, you, talk about one of my other favorite textile artists, Bisa
Oh,
Butler.
she's incredible. Actually, the first time I saw her work was on a Times magazine. So I was just kind of
Oh,
in the queue, just at the shops, and I saw and I thought, this is Time magazine. It's of a woman in Ghanaian fabrics, and
yeah.
it's stitched. And I was like, yes, finally, the world, the most incredible fabrics, these bright colors. It's a handmade like piece of art on the cover of Time magazine. I was like, this is a world I'm happy to live in.
What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
I always find it difficult to answer questions about current embroidery because I feel like it often comes from a very singular perspective.
True.
There is a huge spectrum of what embroidery is, massive. And I think so if I look at it like from a maybe from like if I like narrow it down and I say, okay, we're looking at crafting perspective or just leisure embroidery. So this it's not about, making clothing that gets sold to, pass down skills. So it's not about like community development. If we're just looking at it like from a perspective, leisure embroidery. What I love about it is that there's a whole spectrum of creative and creativity that you can have. There is a place for you on this like on this spectrum of making. And I think embroidery today has like so much, it's accessible. It's not competitive people to just make. And I think especially when everything is like you're completely bombarded with digital everything. And we have to have a kickback to that. And we have to have like a break from that somewhere in our lives. And it just gives a really easy access point for people to make without this pressure. And that's human. We need it. And I really think that that is like a very powerful thing that it gives us today.
Right, the inclusivity of it and the accessibility of it, I think is so important. And I mean, your journey speaks to that really well, that like you ended up with like a little piece of felt and a needle and a thread, and you, it was like the innate human need and desire to create. I mean, you needed to look busy, but you also, you could have done anything, I guess, to look busy, and that's what you did. And you, all you needed was a tiny piece of fabric and one sharp little object and one thread, one fiber. Yeah, it's The simple, it has such simple building blocks, such simple tools involved. No two people, unless even if you do a kit, no two kits look the same because your cross stitches might go in different directions. You might have different thread colors. You might frame it differently. And there's something so powerful and cool about the fact that something so accessible can have so many different outcomes.
The process is also so valuable. The process of sitting in a meditative space or sitting around people and chatting about it and having this thing, being able to just make. Like with the kids, it's got no, it's pressure. You want to make it right and everything, and you want to follow the lines, and there's a bit of this thinking behind it. But it's kind of not, it's probably not your day job, unless. Something you're doing in front of the TV, something you're doing while you're out with friends, maybe it helps with your anxiety. Maybe it's just like something you're doing to stay creative because your job isn't creative and your work isn't creative. Make and to just literally put down a few stitches and then you and your hands and just a thread and needle and a piece of fabric have grown something has grown from that.
Totally. I could not have said it better myself. It does have all of the ingredients for things that people need. And it's not about the journey or the destination. It's about both. It's about the journey and the destination and all that comes with it. How can people learn more about your work? And do you have anything you would like to promote?
So I have a website, danielleclough.com, and I'm on Instagram as fiance underscore Knowles. So those are the two places that I kind of update. Super active on social media at the moment because I think that I'm just trying to build, okay, because I'm trying to build and I am building a body of work that I'm exhibiting Paradigm Gallery. That's really, really exciting for me. So it's going to be it's my second exhibition. My first exhibition was called Highly Strung. And it just had like a mishmash of things on the wall. Yeah, this one in particular is going to be really special because it's a themed body of work. So it's kind of like a grown up. It's like my first grown up show. So I'm really excited, and I'll be doing workshops in Philadelphia, and I'm heading to New Zealand, so I'll be traveling and working there. Yeah, I'm really, really, really excited about it and experimenting with medium. So I'm working with watercolor for this, and then. I haven't actually told anyone this, and it's a long-term project because I found a amazing manufacturer ha of handmade boxing gloves, and he does in Florida, and he does the most incredible boxing gloves. I'm nearly finished the first ones, which will be sent, which will be prototypes, but they're fully embellished beads, flowers, threads.
Oh my God, thank you so much for telling me. I'm excited to see the Insta post, the inevitable eventual Insta post. Danielle, it has been such a treat to talk to you. Thank you
Oh, it's
so
been
much
amazing.
for this.
Absolutely. It's been amazing. And I hope, we do it again.
Hello again. What a fun interview, right? Thank you to Danielle for the super joyous chat. As I mentioned in our interview, the unexpected theme of the conversation was the joy of color. Color is something that is, of course, present in all embroidery from all over the world and all time periods. Even if something is monochrome, the lack of a broader spectrum of color is a choice. It's ever present, and it can tell us a lot about not only a stitcher's color preferences, but also when and where they were stitching. What dyes were available? Were they dyeing their own threads themselves, or did they purchase their threads already dyed? Did they choose their thread colors, or was that what was given to them, or what they had available? And how have the colors of their needlework faded over time? And is that because of the dye stuffs used, or because it's faded in the light? There are lots of questions to be asked, and color can give us a lot of answers. That is part of the fun of looking at a piece of embroidery's front and back. Often, the back of an old piece of embroidery will show the original colors. A lot of times, the thread colors on the back are really bright, and other times they are more muted. Some stitchers opted for vibrant, almost garish tones, while others chose gentler ones. It's just as Danielle and I were saying, everyone has their own color preferences, tones that bring them joy. And often, embroidery tells that story, relays that joy. a sampler or an embroidered picture or an embellished dress or whatever else tells a story not only through what is stitched and how it's stitched, but also what colors were used in its stitching. For me and Danielle, our joy comes from the brightest of colors. For you, it might be more muted tones. Either way, it's clear that the colors used in embroidery are personal. Just as each stitch tells a story, the colors that get painted onto a canvas with stitches tell tales too. And after that little bit of alliteration, that's all I've got for this episode. Thank you so much to Danielle for the interview and to you all for listening. You should get very excited for Danielle's solo exhibition, which will be held at Paradigm Gallery in Philadelphia in September of this year. I'm sure it'll be amazing. Now go out and stitch some stories and keep your eyes open to color. There's stitching inspiration everywhere. Bye!